Thank you all for coming. This presentation is per request of Emma. It's a lecture that I gave earlier this week, and now I'm giving to you, hoping that it will be of some entertainment. It originally has been presented in connection with the exhibition Wundenkammern, which is the exhibition that is on the second floor, and that if you have visited, it includes a collection of objects and photographs, drawings by artists from, you know, 20th, 21st century, kind of addressing what a Wundenkammern is. And this is what this lecture is mainly about, kind of describing and understanding what the contemporary notion of the Wundenkammern is today, and the way that it has been adopted and interpreted by contemporary artists. First, I would like to bring to your attention the way in which the idea of the museum has transformed, or like make you reflect on that. Today, we are standing in a modern art museum, of course, that has a modern sculpture garden, a busy admissions desk, elevators, hallways, cafeterias. This is somewhat of a departure from the original notion of the museum, or at least the Victorian notion of the museum, the dusty palace-like space that you transit in a silent way, looking at a variety of historical objects. In America, you may know that the notion of the museum originates from a single man, the Charles Wilson Peale, who was arguably the first museum director, the person who opened the first public museum. Something that is interesting to note is that he was also an artist. And in fact, this is a self-portrait entitled The Artist in His Museum. Charles Wilson Peale was an avid collector, a naturalist. He was pretty much a Renaissance man who collected all sorts of objects and items from all over the world. He also knew taxidermy, shoemaking, optometry, dentistry, carpentry, etc. He was quite an extraordinary guy. And at the same time, he would include his own artworks inside the museum. So you will be confronted with like fossils and pieces of bones from mammoth animals, etc., and his own paintings. He also confessed in a letter to his son that he thought the museum was a wonderful place where to meet women. So I guess he had like an ulterior motive to his public education enterprises, you know. But let's fast forward from this year, which is 1822, to 2008, to a 21st century museum based in Los Angeles. I don't know if you have ever visited this area, but it's really one of my favorite museums. It's one located in Culver City, in Venice Boulevard, and it's not a particularly exciting part of LA. It's between a dry cleaner, it's a Chinese restaurant, a Hare Krishna temple, a forensic place. It's usually closed, so most likely if you visit it, you might not be able to get in. But if you're persistent and lucky, and you knock at the door, you might get this guy coming out of the door. His name is David Wilson. He's not related to Charles Wilson Peale, although he's also a museum director. He's the director of the Museum of Jurassic Technology. He's a friendly, short guy. He usually is playing his accordion, usually he's playing Bach or something similar, or he is sitting at the front desk of the museum reading an obscure manual of medicine or dentistry or some sort. The admission price, I think, is very reasonable. I think it's like $3, and it's not very highly enforced, so I think you can get away without paying it. The inside of the museum, however, it's immediately something very, very special that sends you back to those old times of the dusty museum that I was talking about, the Victorian Museum, full of vitrines, dioramas, semi-darkened spaces. It's very small, but the museum is carefully arranged and expertly put together, definitely by somebody who knows how to put together dioramas and museum exhibitions, with a vast variety of didactic materials that make you wander as you wander. One of them is one of my favorite displays, is the one of the African stink ant of Cameroon, an insect whose voice, according to the label is audible to the human ear. Such ant lives in the tropical rainforest and has the peculiarity, as we're told, that is prone to inhale a spore from a fungus that rains from above. Such spore installs itself in the ant's brain. As the ant senses death, it climbs to the top of a tree, clinching itself to it. The spore turns into a fungus that continues to grow into the ant's head until it finally explodes, raining more thousands of spores for other unsuspecting ants to inhale. So this is quite a story. And after you read the label, you might turn to David Wilson and ask him, well, where do you find this information? And David Wilson is likely to send you to tell you, well, I read this in this 1936 edition of Scientific American, which unfortunately I can't find right now. It's kind of lost and misplaced it. Equally of interest is the antler wall, which contains all sorts of horns and antlers. Although the particularly interesting object in the whole space is this particular one that you see here, and it explains, according to the label, that it comes from the Tradescantiano Museum in Oxford, and is described as the horn of Mary Davis of Sawhall, or Cheshire, who died at age 71 in 1688. So the horn is kind of blackish in color and not very hard, but also not very soft, and kind of very strangely well-proportioned. And we're told that men with horns tend to grow them in the front of their head, while women tend to grow them in the back. There's another installation. There's thematic links in the different galleries, and this one is a section of memory. This is the story of Magdalena Delaney and Geoffrey Sonnabend. According to the story, Geoffrey Sonnabend visited the Iguazu Falls around 1915 and ran into this woman, Magdalena Delaney, who was an opera singer who had lost her memory. However, she had not forgotten how to sing. So she was singing in a small opera house in the Iguazu Falls, perfectly remembering the different operas, but had completely forgot her identity. And this led to Geoffrey Sonnabend, according to the label, to develop the model of obliviscence, which is a theory of memory that had to do with the conjunction of experience and events that was an elaborate explanation for Magdalena Delaney's ability to have forgotten her memories, but not forgotten her music. As perhaps an example of Sonnabend's theory, he was completely forgotten by history. And again, asking David Wilson, where did you find this information? He will be welding Northwestern University in Chicago, where he studied. You know, there's like a book, which of course, you know, is very hard to find, you know? And so on goes, you know, with the different explanations and didactic materials. That, you know, you have, once you are there, you realize that given David Wilson's amazing ability to create explanations and dioramas, you have no idea what you're looking at, whether it's true or not. And especially you become very suspicious when you are entering to a place like this, which is the exhibition on Jacob Sandalian, who, according to him, was an Armenian violinist who would carve sculptures out of human hairs and place them inside the eye of a needle. And he will also paint them and decorate them. When you enter into the room, there's a number of microscopes, so it's very hard to really know what you're really looking at when you see this. Or when you look at another microscope and see this. Another section of medical remedies goes into similar detail on different practices, such as how to cure thrush, the common mouth infection that children usually get. Basically, you have to suck on the mouth of a duck, you know. There's also mice on toast and mouse pie to prevent anything from a whooping cough to stammering. Also, it's according to the label, if your kids are peeing on the bed, if you give them a slice of mouse pie, they will soon do it, stop doing it forever on. Then there's another section, a very extensive section on nanotechnology. And about small objects, basically. And he's explaining to us that the Museum Tradescantianum in Oxford, from which part of this collection comes, has a lot of these items. And again, it's very hard to tell what you're looking at when you're in looking at these vitrines, that, you know, these objects are very small and kind of place very far inside the vitrine. Here we are presented with what is described as an almond stone, which is this little object inside here, that we are told... The front is carved with a Flemish landscape in which is seated a man wearing a biretta, a long tunic of classical character, and thick soiled shoes. He's seated with a vial between his knees. In the distance are representations of animals including a lion, a bear, an elephant ridden by a monkey, a boar, a dog, a donkey, a stag, a camel, a horse, a bull, a bird, a goat, a lynx, and a group of rabbits. The latter under a branch of which sit an owl, another bird, and a squirrel. On the back is shown an unusually grim crucifixion with a soldier on horseback. The dimensions is 13 millimeter by 11 millimeter. So this is the time, I think, when you will go back to David Wilson and ask him, well, what exactly is this place? You know? So he might give you one of those introductory museum pamphlets that we have all over the museum, kind of explaining the mission of the museum, which reads as follows. The Museum of Jurassic Technology in Los Angeles is an educational institution dedicated to the advancement of knowledge of the lower Jurassic. Like a coat of two colors, the museum serves as a dual function. One, to be a repository of objects for the academic community of the lower Jurassic, and on the other hand, the museum serves the general public with a hands-on experience of life in the Jurassic. Well, again, this might not have really explained anything in any way, you might have realized, however, that regardless of what this museum represents in terms of, you know, veracity or fiction, of the things that it's presenting, it is very clear that the Museum of Jurassic Technology is a Wunderkammer, a contemporary Wunderkammer. It's no ordinary museum. And the best explanation that we have from a place like this really does come back to the times of the discovery of the Americas, and the times where the conquistadors and explorers that came to this continent found such extraordinary objects that in a certain moment we entered a phase of wonder and discovery. This is an Aztec goddess, Coatlicue, whose head is, you know, composed of two serpents, and she has a necklace of human hearts. I mean, these are the kind of things that the Spanish conquistadors were encountered with. And in an interesting way, the whole era of exploration led to the creation of these collections that in the 16th and 17th centuries, Wunderkammerns, that included objects from faraway lands that were things like amazing animals that were not at that time still explained or explored, things like the hand of a mermaid, you know, objects that were kind of a fantasy and wonder, and other things such as an etching by Dürer. And so art, spirituality, religion, nature, and anatomy, all those things were together in the same location, displayed in the same museum. In this particular slide, you see the Museum Wormianum, one of the famous European collections at the time, and you can see this guy here who was kind of a midget that was kind of the curator of the collection for this European nobleman, and apparently, according to some stories, when the curator or this man died, he was embalmed and made part of the collection. So I'm not sure if he's already here in life, already embalmed as part of one of the pieces of the show. That spirit of display and education and wonder kind of continued over the years in Europe. And here you're looking at the Theatrum Anatomicum in Leiden, in Holland, which is was a space where public dissections would take place, mostly of criminals, and they were actually entertainment for the public. People actually would come and you know, look at how they would open up a body. At the same time, the Theatrum Anatomicum was kind of like a town hall of sorts, and it will be kind of decorated with images like this. These actually were tableaus that were usually representing biblical scenes and moralistic scenes, with pieces of with dissected horses and other skeletons and things like that. So they will basically become like a museum of natural history of sorts. And you can see the antlers also on the walls and all these other objects. So museums really kind of become they start becoming a social space of learning and also of experiencing some sort of a spectacle. Another important predecessor of the museums, or the modern museum, is the public collection of the Collegium Romanum by the Jesuit German scholar Athanasius Kirchner, who traveled to Egypt and brought with him a number of obelisks and other items that were he considered worth studying for historical reasons. But you know, we cannot get into the whole history of museum making, and I think we need to kind of again fast forward to the press to the relative present, or at least to the early 20th century, where in the modern tradition, the artists who basically you can see on the walls here in this museum reflected on these issues and kind of adopted that vocabulary of the museum to make their work. The first one that makes the perfect sense to start with is Marcel Duchamp, who in 1935 made this piece called Boîte en Valise, which actually was the first piece that the museum collected of his work. And he was pretty much, as usual, ahead of his time, thinking that he wanted to basically make like a selection of his greatest hits in a little box. So he basically made all these reproductions of some of his famous pieces, like, you know, the big glass and the new descending staircase and the urinal and so on and so forth. And it would be a little box that you could carry with yourself. So in a way, it was kind of like what still the education department does here, the museum in a box, something that we send to schools with reproductions. It's kind of like this idea of accessorizing his works for the consumption of the market. But it's a dollhouse museum representing his works. Eli Sitsky in the 1920s, he reflects on the museum also as a cabinet. But in this case, he designs a space for his own work called Cabinet der Abstrakten, essentially a space for the what's now the Sprengel Museum, where he kind of visualized the ideal of way in which his work could be displayed on a particular location. Then, you know, if you really go now to the 1960s, we need to refer to a very important influential artist of the time, Marcel Broders, and still influential now, who wanted to fully embrace the whole notion of the museum and kind of by creating his own museum. So he invented the Museum of Modern Art, Department of Eagles, which is really kind of a conceptual museum that he described himself as a political parody of artistic events and an artistic parody of political events. I mean, essentially, the Broders Museum was a parody, a satire on the whole self-importance and the historical relevance that museums self-ascribe to themselves. It's a commentary, of course, on the commercialization of art history. And he basically adopts the entire format of the museum by becoming the self-appointed director, organizing exhibitions. And another important thing is that the museum did not have a permanent physical location, but it was more a conceptual idea that would travel to different places. So he will do a show in a biennial. He will present the works in the space of the biennial as kind of like one of the wings of the museum. So I think he's very influential for what really comes next in a lot of works of artists in the 80s and 90s. One example is Fred Wilson, whose work here also was a kind of like it was one of the triggering works that the seminal works in the what we now call the institutional critique. He was invited by the Baltimore Historical Society to basically do anything he wanted with the collection of the museum. So Fred Wilson kind of reviewed all the different items that the museum had, which kind of like traditional decorative arts from, you know, the United States history. The only thing he did really was to rearrange the placement of some of these objects and take out some of the objects that were kind of hiding on the storage. He did things like this, which was putting together like this silverware from the 18th century along with these shackles that belonged to a slave from the same period. He changed the only thing he did was to change the didactic materials or the label to read American metalwork 18th century. So by just doing that simple gesture, you know, he's basically kind of bringing to our attention the way in which museums the reading, the historical readings on museums is problematic, and it's so depending on the political position that, that we may have, and that, that it's really hard to avoid any sort of political positioning in the display of art. Going on these political and economic connections with museums, we have Hans Hacke, who is a, of course, this is not by Hans Hacke, but he did a piece about this particular painting by Seurat. Hans Hacke is a conceptual artist that's originally from Germany, who lives in New York, and he set his eyes on this piece, which is a painting, as I said, by Seurat, called Le Possesse, which is from 1888. And what he basically does with that painting, he basically traces the resume of the painting based on the collectors and the buyers, the people who owned the painting in the past. And he goes into creates a series of panels that describe the situation and conditions in which the piece was purchased and then acquired and then sent to the, or sold to the same, to the next person. And in the exhibition, which this was in 1975, so this was a while ago, but you can see here like the whole history of the painting with the actual painting here, you know. And what Hack is really doing with this piece is really kind of questioning like the whole notion of art history as becoming this only the being the history of the formal and aesthetic qualities of a piece, you know, and kind of unveiling kind of like the kind of like backstage story of a particular work and how an artwork can be seen not only as a piece portraying like aesthetic values, but also a piece that is an object, that is a commercial object that is commercialized with and exchanged. In another kind of another take on this notion of institutional critique, there is Barbara Bloom, who in 1989 he made this piece called The Reign of Narcissism. Basically, if you see this piece, you know, you might recall the period rooms that you might encounter in places like the Metropolitan Museum, where you enter and you are basically in the Louis XIV room or in the Napoleonic era room, etc. And she basically makes a kind of a reproduction of one of those rooms, kind of like in the imperial Napoleonic style, with the only difference that she has really put her face everywhere. So she is the faces on the Roman statuesque pieces are her face. She's like lying here in this kind of relief. There's like all this jewelry with her face as well. So it's kind of like a very fancy memorial to herself. That is why the piece is called The Reign of Narcissism. And of the piece, she has written that her goal was to create a work that was pretty and obnoxious at the same time, both a critique of beauty and a collection of the things that I like the most. And I would add, I mean, it's also a reflection on the artist about his or her own fate with the museum. The whole notion that, you know, museum artists fantasize generally about this notion that, you know, their work will end up in this museum as some sort of mausoleum that is kind of like an eternal space devoted to admiring their work. And in a way, I think she's very kind of taking like an ironic approach about how artists have these projections on the museum space. Also, in kind of in a more ironic way, we also have Alan McCollum, an artist who also in the 80s, wanted to make a commentary on the way that museums collect obsessively, and this whole thing that, you know, he has said, you know, when I walk into a museum, I just see so many objects, you know, like what does it all mean? You know, who chose all these objects? What are they? Why are they valuable? So he invented these pieces called the surrogates that are works that are like hundreds and hundreds and sometimes like thousands of them of the same type. These are like small frames made of plaster in a way to try to obliterate the whole idea of the specialness of a particular work of art inside the museum, trying to like work against the whole notion that one single object is so special. And his work has been kind of like an elaboration of that. Like, how can you just make an infinite amount of artworks? You know? Christian Boltanski, you know, is an artist who takes a little bit more of a poetic approach. And there's something mournful about the way that that he sees museums collect and display art. Basically, he has asserted that quote, we can preserve things only by stopping life's course, unquote. In his archives, there's always these blurred photographs of hundreds of anonymous individuals that are kind of become like this very melancholic evocation. He's known for basically collecting objects, that he, photographs of people that mostly people have disappeared in the Holocaust, finding them in shops in thrift shops, kind of like taking that anonymity and putting them there. He has also written about this work. None of these superimposed faces tell us anything about the destiny of these beings. The different lives of each of them remain unknown to us. They are next to each other, they who had no reason to meet, waiting until some can name them again. And, you know, if you, since you have worked here at this museum, you might have you might recognize that these are hanging racks from the back of a museum. Kind of, this is kind of like the back stage of the museum, and the whole idea that this piece remains there dormant until somebody kind of recognizes it is kind of like a powerful symbol. Sophie Call, who's another artist that has reflected on kind of like this melancholic absence, but in a different way. There's a museum in Boston, which perhaps you know, the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. It was a museum that belonged to a very rich, wealthy collector that was mainly focused on Renaissance and medieval and Renaissance art, and also like 17th, 18th century. She, when she died, she left a big endowment for the museum to remain exactly as it was, without any piece being moved forever. It so happened, though, that in 1990, there was a big theft in that museum, and there were major works that were stolen. And you can still go to that museum today, and because of the mandate of the museum to not alter the look of the museum, you can still see the places where all these pieces are missing. So what Sophie Call did is she approached a number of guards, visitors, and other regulars associated with the museum and asked, interview them regarding their memories and recollections of what those pieces were. And it is what you see on the left is essentially the transcription of some of those interviews, and it's very interesting about the particular piece that is missing right now here. And it's very interesting to see how these descriptions differ. Somebody saying things like, oh, this woman, there was a woman in the painting and she was leaning to the left and there was a little dog on the side. And then another one will say, well, there was a man on the back and she was looking very sad. And they will conflict with each other, kind of bringing to light the notion that, that every painting really changes constantly in the mind of the viewer. Susan Hiller, a British artist who also takes on the whole idea of collecting and archiving with this piece called From the Freud Museum. It's a number of boxes, like archival boxes, with objects that are very enigmatic. They don't really have a very particular meaning, and they really vary of type and material. Basically, it's the vitrine installation of things that evoke historical points, psychic, ethnic, sexual, political disturbances. And another artist who is in the show, the Wonder Carmen show upstairs, Mark Dion, who is perhaps the most associated of contemporary artists with Wonder Carmen's, because he is very interested in natural history museums and in the Renaissance methods of display that are commonly connected to the Wonder Carmen. He has been also in an exhibition that many of these works were at as well, the Museum as Muse, 1999, here at MoMA. And he was also involved in a project in 2004 here during the construction of this new building, where he was invited to work on the digs of the subsoil of the museum. And a lot of the objects that he found that were located quite really deep bottom here are now on display here upstairs at the museum. It's a really interesting way to look at the history of the particular the grounds where the museum is erected. Herbert Distel, it's one of my favorites. He's a Swiss artist, or was a Swiss artist. He's still alive, I think. He made this museum of drawers, where he asked famous artists such as Richard Serra, Jasper Johns, Rauschenberg, to submit a one-inch piece for his little museum. So it's kind of like a bunch of drawers where you can actually open it and then see like a tiny drawing or like a little piece of a sculpture. And it's kind of like a miniature museum of like all the artists that you see in places like the like MoMA. It's kind of like what he writes, museums, especially museums of fine art, are places where we become conscious of time. Like preserving a jar, they have the task of conserving and presenting a subject curled with time, which is the artwork. But through and behind these works, the artists appear, falling out of the screen time, as it were, and become immortal. Barton Lidicevanich, also another one of my favorites, who's not very kind of well known. He lives in New York. He is now, unfortunately, very ill. He's dying of AIDS right now. But a major artist from the 80s who started like collecting objects, and he is perhaps the one that reminds one more of the whole idea of the reliquaries of the, you know, those kind of like little objects and items that belong to saints, you know, that is such an old tradition to keep. But his interests really range from like he basically collects items of famous people, and he really ranges from historical to celebrities to other artists. So he also kind of has his own like museum of drawers. But these are more like objects that he grabs or like little pieces of a piece that he stole or that he found. He's kind of an avid eBay purchaser of historic items, and he exchanges like things that, you know, with other collectors of other objects, you know. And of course, you know, Damien Hirst, you know, he's when you really think about Wonder Caverns and the whole idea of displaying of natural objects, curiosities, and dead animals in boxes. Well, you can see now where that whole idea of Damien Hirst's work comes from. You know, so it's not such a new thing as you might expect it. But, I want to just bring up Francis Alise, a Belgian artist who lived in Mexico City. He lives in Mexico City. He also plays a little bit with the notion of collecting in this particular piece where he showed this at the Hispanic Society, which is like uptown, as a DIA project, DIA Foundation project. He has been collecting for many years this picture of this particular saint that it appears kind of in early Roman times. And she has been painted over and over again by many, many popular painters. And you can always buy her effigy, her exactly in the same profile form, by in like a, you know, flea markets and things like that. And he has hundreds of those paintings, some of them made really crude and some of them like really well made, very academically painted, others just like completely strange and kind of like childish paintings. But in a way, he kind of brings forth the notion that there's these alternative markets. You know, he kind of becomes like this collector of these like religious art market, and how it's it how he kind of really questions the whole notion of the icon and the religious icon. But, you know, speaking about, you know, all these collections, I do want to bring up that the Oxford Museum, which is this museum that founded modern collections in many ways, and which is a museum that is referenced constantly by the Museum of Jurassic Technology, does have an interesting history and a catalog that you can actually check out. This one is from 1859, and there's pictures of the of some of the objects in that museum that might be of interest to us. One of them is what is called an almond stone, and it's in the description. You can read the following: the front is carved with a Flemish landscape in which is seated a man wearing a biretta, a long tunic of classical character, and thick-soled shoes. He's seated with a vial between his knees. In the distance are representations of animals, including a lion, a bear, an elephant ridden by a monkey, a boar, a dog, a donkey, a stag, a camel, a horse, a bull, a bird, a goat, a lynx, and a group of rabbits. On the latter, on a branch on which sit an owl, another bird, and a squirrel. On the back is shown an unusually grim crucifixion with a soldier on horseback. So, anyway, it's true. It's true also that Jefferson Sonnabend did live, and indeed the book on memory that he wrote is located at Northwestern University's libraries. If you go into the notes and queries section by William White from Oxford University Press in 1903. You can read in the section of remedies for epilepsy and thrush that, and I think it's located somewhere around here, a common cure is to catch a duckling, place its mouth wide open within the one of the affected child, and as the sufferer inhales the duck's breath, the complaint will disappear. This is Jacob Sandalian, who actually did live, in fact, and the pieces that you saw are actually the real pieces by him. It is actually a tradition in Armenia to actually make miniatures, which I didn't know about. And his son describes very much in detail how he used to work with a microscope between heartbeats in order to not be distracted by or altered by the pulse. If you really think about nanotechnology and making small things, I mean, it's really not surprising that you can make something so small. This is actually the first paragraph of Charles Dickens's The Tale of Two Cities, printed on the head of a pin. And these are two Chinese women from Shangshan in South China who have horns on their forehead or on the back of their head. Jan Bonenson, a researcher, devotes a chapter of his book, The Two-Headed Boy and Other Medical Marvels, to horned people, and summarizes both the impressive historical record and the medical explanations. Turns out that these things called horns, they're actually keratinized epithelial cells that don't have a bone core. They do appear in the head, they are skin warts of sorts, and they basically are related to skin tumors related to carcinomas of the skin. But they do kind of look like horns. And of course, the ant of Cameroon is a totally true story. So anyway, that's something that you might want to think about, and also you might want to explore the local museums of our neighborhood or city that kind of resemble aspects of the Museum of Jurassic Technology. One of them is a city reliquary in Brooklyn, which is located at 370 Metropolitan Avenue in Williamsburg, and basically it features collections of different community collections, antique objects from the city, and remnants of city buildings and things like that. There is Salon de Fleurus, which is in Little Italy, which I also highly recommend to see. It only opens late at night, you know, from 8 to 11 p.m., and it's a fairly mysterious place that it's really worth not describing in detail, only that you should know that the Rue de Fleurus is a place where Gertrude Stein used to live, and that was the first place where the paintings of Picasso, Braque, and Cézanne were exhibited together for the first time. And of course, one of my favorite museums is the Museum of Bad Art, which is actually located in Boston. And it's a museum, a collection started by a man named Jerry Riley, who basically found a painting in the trash, and he thought it was too bad that was so good. Oh, actually, yeah, basically. It was so bad that it actually was really good. And he thought that it was important to actually start preserving these really bad works for the ages. Pretty soon, the museum started really becoming like Wunderkammern of bad art. And now it's really famous. You can actually check the MoBA website. And what I really love the most is actually the descriptions of the museum, because he really is a great label writer. And for example, I'm going to describe this painting called Genus Demons. He also titles the paintings because obviously they're all anonymous, so he kind of has to come up with the titles himself. But for example, this one, the description goes, frightening non-kosher demons haunt this blonde, blue-eyed beauty in a see-through blouse. Her world is cracking apart at the edges, but her careful hairdo and makeup shows that she knows it is important to keep up appearances. So we could say that this work and this collection and the ones of the Museum of Jurassic Technology and other of these amazing artists, the appearances that are kept are the ones of discovery. And the discovery that, you know, we have, never without a bit of irony, and always fueled by that everlasting sense of wonder. Thanks. Thank you. Do you guys have any comments, questions, complaints?
Mm-hmm. What was the place in Queens again?
It's in Brooklyn.
No,
it's not. That's not in Queens. It's in Little Italy.
Little Italy.
It's on It's on Spring Street and Mulberry. I believe it's 41 Spring, but you have to maybe do a search on it, and you have to actually call in advance because the guy who runs it is kind of unpredictable too. Like you never know he really is gonna be there, and he really likes to just keep it small. He likes only a very small group of visitors at a time, like maybe two or three. And it's actually best when you actually go in a small group, because with large group the whole experience is completely lost. It is kind of like a performance, so it's better not to really go too much into it.
What's the name of the place?
Salon, S-A-L-O-N, D-E-S, Fleurus, F-L-E-U-R-U-S. Mm-hmm. It's actually perfect for you who, you know, now have experienced this museum and this collection to actually go there, because it's all about the birth of modernism. You know, it's about the foundational myths about modernism. It's really a really quite a wonderful thing.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With the Hans Hacke piece about the Seurat painting, I wondered whether I think that painting is in the Barnes Foundation.
Yes, that's correct.
And I wondered whether that was part of the motivation, because the Barnes itself is sort of a Wunderkammer space, you know, and because the ownership by that one collector is so important to that, I wondered whether that was part of the motivation for that piece.
Well, you know, Hans Hacke's work really... if you really look at all the pieces that he's made, I mean, a lot of his work is about power and about about influence and kind of be critical of that. So, I mean, I think the Barnes collection was like a good kind of case study for him. But it's by no means the only piece that he has done kind of in that kind of line. I mean, one of his most famous works that actually was never really a work because it was censored. It was in 1971 at the Guggenheim. Where he was a young artist, you know, his early 30s, and he was given a solo show, and the work consisted in having a display of all the properties of a few of the trustees of the Guggenheim, you know, like kind of like a full display of the kind of like all of everything they owned, and the piece was censored. The show was canceled. The curator was fired, you know, and. It was a huge scandalous exhibition. And ever since that time, Hans Hacke has never exhibited at the Guggenheim. You know, so it's actually really... I mean, his work has always, like, pushed the envelope in that regard. And, I mean, I think that the Barnes, yes, definitely was... I mean, he was very interested in the whole idea of the collector. He wanted to find a collector who, with kind of like a big financial means and things like that. So I think the piece did, in fact, kind of fit the parameters I was looking for.